Welcome back to Canucks Talk. Josh Elliott Wolf, Thomas Drantz here with you, coming to you live from the Kintech studio, and you can text in 650-650 Dunbar Lumber text line. Canucks Talk is brought to you by the Hockey Shop in Langley. Shop in-store or online at thehockeyshop.com. As a texter points out, so we mentioned Mackenzie Blackwood on his way to Colorado, traded from San Jose, joining the Wood duo in net, Scott Wedgwood, Mackenzie Blackwood. They also have Miles Wood, as Dalvier points out on the text box.
Yes, they do.
So watch out for Sherwood.
Oh, no.
So they're coming for him.
Start up the rumors. I like that.
But yeah, a lot of wood in Colorado. We'll see how their goalie wood works out moving forward. Before
when
the break,
they play in LA, they play in Hollywood.
Wow. Here we go. What else can we do here? Anyway, before the break, I said I had a game for you, and I titled it Worry or Whatever, which is just kind of, it's just kind of our version of Boom or Doom. Domino. Big Costco guy over there.
I just love the jigsaw drop. We have Coach Jigsaw, which has been a long-standing nickname for Rick Tocchet, who likes to refer to himself as a puzzle guy, big puzzle guy.
Big puzzle guy.
Coach Jigsaw.
Yeah.
And now we have the I'd like to play a game drop, which we should use more because I always am playing weird games with our hosts. You've brought one to the table.
I brought one.
How brazen of you.
I know.
To mow my lawn.
So bold. I'm sorry.
Let's go.
Okay. So, basically, worry or whatever. You just tell me if this is a legitimate concern or if it's like, hey, whatever. So the first one, against teams that Dom's model has at above 40% to make the playoffs, the Canucks hold a 3-6-2 record through 11 games.
Okay. Sorry. Give it to me one more time so I can play the game right.
Okay. So against teams
yep.
that Dom's model has at playoff odds of over 40%.
Right.
The Canucks hold a 3-6-2 record.
Okay.
So is that a worry or is it whatever?
It's 10 games, right? Like we're talking about 9-8. How many games was that?
11
nine?
Games.
11 games. Probably too small a sample to be a worry, but you'd certainly like to see them have some confidence-building performances against good teams. I think we're in this odd moment where I think people want to take the fact that the Canucks have amassed a decent record. It hasn't been bang-rang, but it's been solid in their absences, right? They have 11 points in 9 games since without JT Miller. And Besser was absent for part of that. Hronek was absent for part of that. Demko was absent for all of that. So, you know, I think people want to take that as evidence of this team's quality. And I see it as the Canucks winning a run of coin flips, right? The multiple overtime wins, this 2-0 win over Boston, really a one goal game with an empty netter in which, if we're being totally honest, the Canucks were outplayed, right? I mean, they barely had the puck for 60 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had a really nice performance against the Ottawa Senators, even though that was a one goal win. You know, I think the truth is that they were by far the better team and it just got a little tighter than it was. And I thought they played well, certainly in the second half of the game against the Columbus Blue Jackets, even though there were some visible seams. And then Tampa Bay outplayed them last night, right? I mean, Tampa Bay got lucky. The way that Tampa Bay won was fortunate, right? But the form of both teams, I think, left very little doubt about which team deserved to come away with 2 points. It was pretty clearly the Avalanche.
They deserved to win, but the way they won was a little lucky.
But
they should have won.
But they were the superior team on the afternoon,
yep.
right? And so, you know, I'm not worried about Vancouver's inability to lose to beat elite teams in the first quarter of the year. Whatever, right? We haven't seen what this team is. We haven't seen them fully composed. That doesn't concern me at all. What concerns me, though, is a run of 9 games where you're playing coin flip hockey. Because especially when you're winning a run of those coin flips and it looks good for a bit, at the end of the day, like if you flip a coin 10 times, you're probably not getting heads 5 times and tails 5 times. You're probably getting 7 or 8. you know, and then and then over time
it balances out.
And that's what I expect here. Like, if the Canucks can't materially find ways to control play better, I think they're going to be in tough against this Blues team that will be very well rested. I think they're going to be in tough against the Florida Panthers on Thursday. I think they're going to be in tough to get through this stretch, you know, without Miller. Well, like, Demko and Miller are going to be back hopefully in the next couple weeks, and there's going to be rust to shake off for both of them, right? We're not going to expect 100% Demko, although, man, that would be a sick story.
Yeah.
We're not going to expect 100% JT Miller after, you know, 3 to 4 weeks off. That's unrealistic. That's not how this works. So, you know, there's going to be some growing pains here. It's going to be a while. It's going to be a month or more. Usually after about 30 games, I like to talk about having some certainty about what a team is. I think we're going to have less than ever. I think this team is going to be an incredible black box relative to the rest of the league. So anyway, to play your game, my answer is I'm not concerned about their record against elite teams. I'm far more concerned right now anyway about their inability to control play and how fortunate they've needed to be across these 9 games in Miller's absence to just grind out wins, right? Like, to 11 points in 9 games is creditable. It's like you've held the fort. But if this stretch continues, if their form doesn't spike significantly, it's the bad results are going to come.
The thing I felt yesterday, and like justifiably so, it just felt like they were missing that second punch that they usually have when they have both JT Miller and Elias Pettersson. And it's kind of felt like they've been missing it all season, because to an extent, we all know the struggles Elias Pettersson had to start the season, and then he kind of seemed to figure it out at the same time as JT Miller leaving the lineup. So it just hasn't felt like they've had two elite lines going at the same time. And it's kind of been not easy for other teams to neutralize the Canucks' top talent, but it's been easier than it would be if they were operating at the optimal version of what this team can be. And we just haven't really seen that yet this season. And yesterday, to me, it felt especially it stood out a lot more than it had in the past to me when I was watching that game yesterday. Okay, so the next one I had is worry or whatever. According to Jay Fresh, the Canucks are 30th in the league in 5-on-5 expected goals per 60, just over 2.1, but third in expected goals against per 60 at just over 2.1.
Very worried.
Very worried.
Very worried. That is a massive issue for this team. It's great that they can defend well, but we do not live in a world with 920 goaltending anymore. We live in a world with 890 goaltending. Like, we live in a world where you can finish on 11% of your chances. And in that world, in a world where shots have more value than they ever have before, or not ever, but since like the late 80s, early 90s, since the advent of the butterfly, shots are more valuable today in hockey than they ever were previously, right? Certainly for most of my adult life, right? The games have been won by the teams that control play, right? And in that world where everyone, you know, average save percentage is 919 at 5-on-5, right? In that world, territorial dominance, controlling the flow of shots, maximizing how much control you have is everything, because that jukes your odds of getting the bounce that you need to score goals. But the world we're living in now, you know, you need to be able to manufacture, because if you can outmanufacture a great defensive team, the chances you're creating are that much more valuable, right? So being a sharp defensive team is obviously crucial. You're not going to win a Stanley Cup if you can't defend. Period. But if you're, and we're not talking about average.
No.
We're talking about near the bottom of the league.
They are 30th. The only teams below them, Chicago and Detroit.
If you're not, yeah, right. If you're not generating, like if this team was 14th and third defensively, I'd say that's fine.
That'd be great.
You're probably good enough defensively that you'll have a shot most of the time. But fundamentally, if you're going to win, you need to be manufacturing looks at an elite rate. Like, what do the Edmonton Oilers and the Florida Panthers, last year's Stanley Cup finalists, have in common? No one generates more 5-on-5 except the Carolina Hurricanes, and that might have been something of a scam, which is why they've completely reinvented the way that they attack. The Canucks tried to do the same, And so far, the results haven't been there. This team does not look more dangerous offensively over the whole 25 games. Hopefully, Miller can help them there. There were good signs in the first five or six games that, you know, some of their rush attacking had come to the fore. But, you are period not winning a Stanley Cup with that level of ability to generate quality looks 5-on-5. You are not. Period. So the Canucks have to absolutely change their stripes in that order to be considered a contender.
Has it felt, because we heard so much about, hey, this coaching staff, they want to attack more off the rush and change how this team approaches things offensively. Has it felt like they've done that? Because to me, it's felt like very similar to last year. And I almost wonder if, hey, they saw the trouble early in the season and just pulled back the reins again.
Well, or I think, though, early in the season, though, you think about like that Chicago game. I thought there were signs of this team having a dynamic attacking gear that they maybe lacked last season.
Yes.
But, you know, I think it's possible that they've turned the dial back a little bit in the absence of some of their key top of the lineup players, Hronek and Miller in particular. I'm, you know, something to ask Tocchet. I'll ask him tomorrow at after morning skate, actually, because it's an interesting thing to query. But the, you know, I thought there were a lot of signs about how this team wanted to play differently and how they successfully were playing differently earlier on in the year. And I just feel like I feel like the evidence of it is disappearing rapidly.
Yeah, I agree. And we will see if maybe it comes back a little bit more, like you said, with the potential return of JT Miller and Filip Hronek at some point shortly. The next one, Elias Pettersson and Brock Besser playing together since Besser returned to the lineup. They have this stat line at 5-on-5. They have 45% of the shot share, 3 goals for, 6 goals against, and they're even in high danger chances for and against. It kind of felt like when they were put together, because if you remember, Kiefer Sherwood was playing with Jake DeBrusk and Elias Pettersson, and that line had a run of success. It was looking really good, and then they kind of ran into some issues. Maybe they weren't creating as much, and it did feel like the obvious option to go to was Brock Besser going back to that line and just loading up the offensive pieces you currently have to try to maximize what you can do. Is that line, that duo of Elias Pettersson and Brock Besser playing together, are they doing enough? Is that a worry, or is that whatever?
So, I mean, I'm not worried about Brock Besser and Elias Pettersson, just kind of period.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, of this team's concerns, those do not concern me at all. I think one thing that I guess worries me a little bit is in the context of the is Pettersson back conversation, right? And I feel like that conversation has at least reached a more normal pitch. You know, 3 weeks ago, people were not being normal. Like, it was impossible for people to just have a conversation about Elias Pettersson without, you know, like bringing up something wild, like calling him a 60-point player, or like,
yeah,
bringing up 11.6, or just like completely losing their minds, right? I feel like it's now a more normal conversation. And yet, I do think one thing that I'm coming out of this stretch of games with is, you know, at least some concern about the fact that the Canucks haven't necessarily been able to control play the way they do usually at the top of the lineup, with Pettersson sort of filling the Miller role and getting that like healthy dose of self-matched minutes alongside Quinn Hughes. Now, look, it's different when it's Quinn Hughes and Tyler Myers than it is when it's Quinn Hughes and Filip Hronek, you know, as creditable a job as Tyler Myers has done. So perhaps that's part of the story here. But since Miller left the lineup, the Canucks have been outscored 7-8 with Pettersson on the ice at 5-on-5, right? They've outshot their opponents, but narrowly, and they've been out-attempted, which is sort of the key number we should look at, mm-hmm, in evaluating sort of small sample run of play stuff. They've been unlucky in those minutes, especially from a goaltending perspective, but it doesn't change the fact that this team's, if you plug Pettersson into the role that Miller has held down, it doesn't seem like you're getting the same robust two-way results that this team was earlier in the season. So to me, that's not nothing. That's not a concern, or at the very least, it's a signal that Pettersson, who I think we know historically is a top-end two-way player, isn't all the way back yet. Even if the conversation, I think, has died down around him, and I think that's a good thing because I think it had really reached an unfair tenor. Unfair is the wrong word, but it had reached a histrionic sort of tenor. Like, I just think it was untenable to keep having the conversation around Pettersson that we'd had in this market. It felt personal. It felt emotional. It was a mania of sorts in this marketplace. And so I think it's good that that's died down. But I also think what we've seen the last 9 games shows us that there's still a gap between Pettersson's form at the moment and his form when he's like John Wick level, I think I'm back.
Yeah, for sure. And it did feel like we were trending towards that. Maybe we still are, but it hasn't seen the continued progression that I think people have wanted to see. And that, like, that's okay. I do wonder if that happens when JT Miller returns, because that game yesterday, it just felt like they were missing that next punch. And also, I think that has an impact down the lineup too, because we're so used to last year when we saw Dakota Joshua and Connor Garland and whoever was in the middle having these momentum-changing shifts for the team and completely controlling play and bringing everything into the offensive zone. And we haven't seen that from them this year. Obviously, it's a unique set of circumstances for Dakota Joshua, and it's kind of hard to grade how long it's going to take for him to get back to where he was last season. But I think the lack of JT Miller and the lack of having those two lines at the top of your lineup is being felt lower in the lineup too.
Mm. I think that's completely fair. Although there have been some positives there too, like Pew Suter.
Yes.
And we should talk about Pew Suter because
he was next on the Worry or whatever.
Okay, well then never mind. I'll get into Worry or whatever with you. I'll kick it back to you so you can set this up.
Thank you. Worry or whatever, Pew Suter is on pace for over 30 goals in a contract here.
Yeah.
Good for him.
That's so cool.
And he's been good.
So is that a worry for me or not?
Are you worried about Pew Suter scoring over 30 in a year where he's due for a contract?
So the funny thing about Pew Suter, right, is, and longtime listeners will know that this is true, right? But before the 2023 offseason, I kept talking about Pew Suter as a guy who I expected to earn like $4.5 to $5 million because there were no other credible top 9 centermen really on the market, except there was someone else. There was like one guy who you knew was going to get paid enormously.
Yeah.
And then it was like Pew Suter, and that was it. And I expected him to make bank because of it. And then he fell through the cracks. My analysis was way off, even though my player analysis was on point. And the Canucks end up getting him for 1.6 times 2. And it's been a massive steal. A massive steal. And now he's on a bit of a shooting percentage heater, right? He's also shooting more. He's playing more. He's driving play. He's been Vancouver's best two-way forward without question over this 9-game segment of games in which JT Miller's been absent. Like, he's been a difference-making two-way piece.
Mm-hmm.
He's been excellent. And he's been scoring a ton against the grain and just, like, painting corners with the shot, doing everything for this team at the moment. And so, am I worried about him going off, popping off offensively in a contract year? I'm not, and here's why. Pew Suter's ability to control games, his versatility, right? The way that he plays hockey like a winning player means that he's perpetually undervalued in some ways because the things that he does so well almost exclusively don't show up in the box score. You look at his listed height. Right, he's 5'11". Well, that's not big enough to be a defensive stopper. You look at his listed weight, 179 pounds. That's a little bit slight for a bottom six center. You look at his offensive production. His career high in points is 36 in a season that he played for a terrible Detroit Red Wings team and finished the year minus 11. Well, cheap points from a soft player who's cheating the game, right? Like, Look at his face-off clip. 46.9 for his career. 44% this season. Well, that's not a guy you can trust in big moments.
Yeah.
Like, everything about him screams tweener to the majority of the hockey world. And yet, if you're actually watching this guy play, shift after shift, touch after touch, play after play, battle after battle, as a first line wing, a second line center, a third line wing, or a fourth line center, on the right side or on the left side, he helps you win. He helps you win his minutes consistently, no matter what else is going on around him, right? No matter who you put him with, they're gonna drive play well. You need a complimentary winger who can actually hang and take nothing off the table from your top players in first line minutes. Pugh Suter's the best winger that this team has for Besser and Miller.
Yeah.
You need a guy who can play second line center and win those minutes because you've got JT Miller out of your lineup for an indefinite period of time. Pugh Suter can do it. So the fact that he's popping off offensively, in my mind, instead of making him one of those pieces who's like overvalued and is one of those, oh, this is one of those classic mistakes that teams make, overpaying, you know, the like depth guy who's on a shooting percentage heater. It's like all that this is going to do potentially is actually make it so that Pugh Suter's industry value, his market value as a free agent, actually matches his real value.
Yeah.
Right? This is a good player, and not just a good player, but a good player with the ability to fill a premium spot, multiple premium spots. Like, I think every team in the league should want to go out and get Pugh Suter at $4.5 million as a top six winger, like a top six defensive ace winger who can play with skilled players. Man, that is hard to find. Like, that is a hard piece to find. He's worth $4.5 million just off of that. If you think he's a middle six center who's going to be a 35 to 40 point guy and can play on the power play and can help you kill penalties and on, then he's a $5.5 to $6 million player.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I don't think you have to pay him like that.
No, he don't. Like, it would be insane if he got 5.5 to 6, in my opinion.
I think all that's going to happen here is that he's going to close the gap, the perceived value gap, and that's good for the player. And by the way, that's still going to be good value for the team that goes out and signs him. He's 28, but I think if you could, he's a guy I'd actually be proactive on if I was the Canucks. Like, I think if you could do 4x4, I think that's a steal. I think you'd get massive surplus value. And if you're out there trying to look for the next Pugh Suter, and in my opinion, failing to recognize the incredible evaluative inefficiency that marked him lasting into August in the summer of 2023 and allowed you the completely rare opportunity to pounce on that, I think you are vastly overestimating how many players that are this good and this versatile in as many facets at premium spots in the lineup there are. Like, this is not a player type that I don't think you can find the next one. I don't think the next one exists. I kind of think he's a little bit 101. He's a guy I'd actually proactively go out and extend if I were in the Canucks' shoes.
So every time the Pugh Suter conversation comes up too, people bring up Nils Höglander and they're like, oh, would you trade Höglander and give him... give Suter Höglander's contract.
I don't think that's enough.
It does feel like you're going to have to give him more, especially if he keeps producing like this. And he just has more of a track record of producing like this.
And you have to remember, like, this guy came into the league on an ELC, okay? And then he was non-tendered by the Chicago Blackhawks, despite having a wild, like, his first NHL season, he played with Patrick Kane. He had 27 points in 55 games in the NHL, and he goes non-tendered, and it was baffling then.
It was so weird, yeah.
It was so weird. And then he lands a two-year contract worth $3.25 million from the Red Wings, and then he falls through to August 11th when the Canucks sign him for 2 years at $3.2 million. So he's got $10 million-ish in career earnings, but he's 28. Like, this is the deal. This is the deal. So I don't think you get the Höglander contract, especially when, like, right now, he's played his last 10 games at center.
Yeah.
I mean, that matters. And by the way, this is one of those things. I don't think Pugh Suter is the type of person where this is going to impact his production or anything like that. But one thing teams do have to consider in maintaining harmony and getting everyone bought in, right, is, like, if you want Pugh Suter on the wing with JT Miller when Miller returns, like, if you want to play a Suter, Besser, Miller top line, you're taking money out of the player's pocket. He would benefit from being this team's third line center over the balance of the season, right? Like, regardless of the production boost that you get from playing with Miller and Besser, that's just how this works. So, you know, that's one thing that teams need to sort of work on in terms of managing personalities and keeping everyone bought in. And again, I don't think Suter's the type of person who will rock the boat one way or the other on it, but just one of those factors that I'm always mindful of in evaluating players and teams.
That is Worry or Whatever on Canucks Talk. It is Josh Elliott, Wolf, Thomas Strantz. On the other side, Kevin Woodley will get into everything going on with Thatcher Demko and more on Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk. Josh Elliott, Wolf, Thomas Strantz, Dom Shermati putting in work on finding new royalty-free songs. This is one of them.
So we were discussing different royalty-free music, and among the songs was Happy Birthday.
Yes.
And that led to us having a long conversation about what the first person that ever heard Happy Birthday thought of the song.
Must have blown their socks
off. I know. I liked your take that they were like, we should do this every year.
we got to do this every year. This is amazing.
I like that take a lot.
You can text in 650-650, Dunbar Lumber text line. We are coming to you live from the Kintech studio in Canucks Talk, brought to you by The Hockey Shop in Langley. Shop in store or online at thehockeyshop.com. We go to the phone lines now. Kevin Woodley, In Goal Magazine and NHL.com, and a presentation of White Rock Hyundai. Woodley, how's it going?
It's going good. You guys just combined my two favorite things in the world.
What?
White Rock Hyundai, where you get treated the right way every time, and the hockey shop, Source for Sports, which has been a sponsor of the In Goal Radio podcast since its inception four years ago, and one of our key partners in the world of In Goal Magazine over the years. So, wow, this is an excellent Mondays. They say it's not a good thing, but this is going so good for me so far.
And let's somebody get off the rails that I used then. To know too.
Hey, Woody, before we get into talking about Demko and his presumptive return this week, let's focus on the big trade, the big goaltender trade. Georgiev going to San Jose, Mackenzie Blackwood going to Colorado, Avs paying a pretty premium to usher in that upgrade. Is it an upgrade? First of all, let's start with that question. Is going from Georgiev to Blackwood an upgrade, or is this just good goalie has lost the confidence of his team and something needed to give?
Well, I mean, it might be a little bit of both. So statistically, it's an upgrade because statistically, Georgiev has just been a mess this year. Like, out of 80 qualifying goalies so far this season, or 80 goalies to play in the league so far this season, his adjusted save percentage ranks 71st. You know, he's almost minus 3%. And a bit of a tougher environment. Colorado's actually cleaned up defensively. You know, I've seen a lot of talk about how bad they are defensively. Overall, right now, 5-on-5 high danger against, their ninth. Expected goals, high danger against, penalty kill, their third. A little bit lower off the rush, 13th, so they're giving up a little more there. But, you know, maybe he bore the brunt of their worst games when they were most affected by injury. His expected save percentage is a little bit below league average. But they've righted the ship, and he hasn't been able to match it. And so I think you had to change it up. And, you know, on balance this season, for sure, Mackenzie Blackwood is an upgrade, but an upgrade who's just slightly above league average. And I talk about the 80 goalies, he's 38. So, you know, there's no guarantees here, obviously. You're getting a goalie who's performed better this season. Over the last three seasons, their numbers are a lot closer than that. You're getting a goalie in Blackwood who is, like, I mean, he's built like a linebacker. He's a pure athlete. There's so much there. And I'm a little surprised, actually, that San Jose gave up on him, because I know when he arrived there and they started working with him, like, they saw number one star potential in the way he moved, in the way he trained, in those physical tools I talked about. And so I thought, you know, amid all the talk of him becoming a popular trade target, I thought they kind of looked at him as a guy who might be able to help them take the next step. And so I'm a little bit surprised by that. But as you said, a premium paid. And their goalie coach in San Jose, Thomas Spear, you know, this wouldn't be the first time he's taken a potential reclamation project and turned it into a positive asset. So I kind of fits both. It checks both boxes, Thomas, in terms of, you know, something had to change because it wasn't working with Georgie. And this season in particular, Blackwood gives them both a statistical upgrade on what they were getting, but also, you know, potentially a higher ceiling. Although at this stage in his career, you know, this would be the first sort of good team he's played on. And with that, you know, sort of asterisk being there, it's probably fair to ask the question, for all the upside that everyone keeps seeing, when does it get delivered upon? Well, now he's behind a good team. Let's see if he can deliver it.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask that. It feels kind of like we've heard about Blackwood for a while and that he's, hey, if he was just on a good team, he can be the guy. Do you see that in him in Colorado?
Yeah, you know what, actually, and the good question to ask on that, and I'm going to run numbers while we talk, so this is me ragging the puck a little bit, would be, you know, bad goals. Like, that's one of the things. Like, is there a tendency to give up bad ones? You know, he's always been good against sort of the high danger stuff. Where does he rank on the bad stuff? Because that's when you're a team like Colorado or when you're a team like Canada, right? Like, that's what you're looking for. I don't think it was a coincidence. Not only Binnington and Aiden Hill have some of the best numbers on low danger chances, but when it came time to choose a third, Montembeau had only given up 3 low danger goals all season, same as Binnington. And Aiden Hill had only given up 1, right? Like, when you're a good team, it's that sort of mantra, and you could argue Colorado won a cup with this. We just need a goalie not to cost us games. We don't need one to win us games. Right now, you know, he's right around league average. He's given up 5 low danger goals on 277 shots, and that's kind of right around expected. So it's not something that kills him. I will say, during his time in New Jersey, you know, health was an issue and ability to stay healthy. And so that kind of became one of the conversations around Mackenzie Blackwood. And I'm not sure it was entirely fair, because there were stretches where he was playing through, well, I'll give you one example. And he played for a long period of time with us. He had what they call a Bauer bump, which is like a growth on your foot from rubbing against the back heel of your skate. Like, it can almost become like a calcium deposit or like a bone growth inside the back. And it was so bad that they actually cut out the back of his skate, cut the heel open, put black tape over it so nobody could tell he was essentially playing with his heel exposed to the wind. And he played through it for a while before having it surgically repaired, I believe, in the off season. So sometimes we judge goalies by their numbers and performance, not knowing what they're going through behind the scenes. And I think for large portions of the New Jersey stint, or at least some of the later periods in New Jersey, he was playing through a lot, not just in terms of what that would take from a pain tolerance standpoint, but frankly, one of the grosser stories I've ever heard.
So Georgiev, I love this for San Jose. My first instinct here, Kevin, is that I think that the San Jose Sharks just got paid to take on a like piece after buying low on Blackwood. So they buy low on Blackwood, resuscitate his value, then get paid to get Georgiev, who, you know, like, I've seen him win a playoff series, or I've seen him at least play really well in a playoff series. We've all seen him win a playoff series, but I mean, he's really good.
Hey, I liked his playoff series when he lost in Seattle. That wasn't on
him. Was phenomenal.
Right? Like, I covered that series, and I thought he was more than fine in that one.
He was killer down low.
Questions around him in Winnipeg, and look how he responded after that first game in Winnipeg. Like, he had numbers in New York that made me think he could be a starter. He looked like a starter at the start in Colorado for whatever reason. And this is sometimes just happens. Sometimes that snowball just gets rolling downhill in terms of the relationship between a goalie and his defense. And, you know, nobody trusts each other. And pretty soon the goalie's trying to do the defenseman job and the defenseman's trying to do the goalie's job. They're all just kind of trying to help each other by cheating a little bit. And pretty soon nobody's doing their own job. And it sort of feels like that might've been where they got to in Colorado. And I'm with you in that I think he's fully capable. And like I said already, Thomas Spear, the goalie coach down in San Jose, as you mentioned with Blackwood, has done this before. I believe he's an excellent goalie. I think you're seeing in Calgary right now with Devin Cooley in the American Hockey League and the success he's having. Certainly the guys in Calgary deserve a big kudos, Mackenzie Skapski, the goalie coach there. But that was a process in talking to Devin Cooley that started with Thomas Spear last year after he arrived in San Jose. And frankly, I was surprised they moved on from him, because I thought they had a really nice reclamation project underway with Cooley. And we sort of see Calgary, after adding some thoughts of their own and some changes of their own, they're reaping the rewards of that. And I think that may be exactly what you see happen with Georgiev in San Jose. He gets a fresh start. The trust is built in, and with a couple maybe small changes under the goalie coach there, wouldn't be surprised to see him finish strong.
With Colorado, they have defensive issues, man. Like, as much as their goaltending hasn't been up to snuff, and you could tell they had the bad goal goes in, whole bench sags vibe going with Georgiev, not unlike what the Canucks had with Delia and Spencer Martin that season in Vancouver. Like, it had clearly become untenable for players and goalie as like a combination. So I get why they've brought in Wedgwood. I get why they've brought in Blackwood, but that can't be an easy environment to go play behind for a goaltender. How does Blackwood's sort of stylistic capabilities fit in what's been a pretty permissive environment?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because the biggest problem there has frankly been the low danger stuff, at least for Georgiev. Like, he's given up 8 low danger goals this season on just 190 shots. Like, that's really underwater. It's the biggest problem for him statistically. And so you're right. Like, that's the problem both statistically and what that does to a team, right? When the bad goes in, you lose that faith and that confidence. Cause like I said, overall, I mean, they're mid pack against the rush. They give up too much off the rush, but they're not, like, this isn't the Canucks under Bruce Boudreau. They're not giving up. Again, early in the season, it was worse. But on the whole this season, it's not that bad. Like, it's top 10 5-on-5, just barely, but top 10 5-on-5 and third in terms of high danger expected goals against on the PK. They've been killed because bad goals have gone in too much. And ironically, like, when I look at, you know, Georgiev have given up 8, like, there's only 2 goalies in the league that have given up more, and that's Grubauer on just 135 chances in Seattle and Kevin Lankinen in here in Vancouver, but on far more chances on 284, which that probably surprises some people to see that number. Georgiev's been average on the other stuff. It's just that's killing him for the most part. And so in Blackwood, you get a goaltender who in San Jose transitioned to playing a bit of a quieter game. He is, like I said, he's massive. He's built for this, so to speak. He's huge. He's powerful. And if he reins in that power and keeps it under control, like, he should be better just courtesy of a lot more pucks hitting him and not going through him the way they were on Georgiev. And there's a rigidity to Georgiev's game that seemed to have developed in Colorado, where there's just a stiffness and almost looks like tension. And maybe when things go bad, you try too hard and that never works. As Ian Clark was, you know, famous for saying here in Vancouver, tension is the enemy of goaltending. And I see a little bit of that in his game. I think just courtesy of losing the bad goals, for all the focus on Colorado being bad defensively, the underlying numbers don't paint the picture that it's quite that bad. And the biggest thing that they need is a save on the easy stuff, and they haven't had enough of them, and they should get more of them from Blackwood.
It is Canucks Talk. Josh Elliott, Wolf Thomas Drance, joined by Kevin Woodley of In Goal Magazine. So on to Thatcher Demko. I think for me and a lot of people looking at this Demko situation on Friday when they said he was going to back up, it kind of felt weird to me. Like, hey, if he's ready, don't you want him to start a game as opposed to, hey, potentially have to come into a game cold? What was your read on that situation?
It would be similar, right? Like, And not in a critical way, but just it's a little peculiar. It's not the norm, right? Like, we've seen other goalies come back recently, and if they're the starter, they come back and they start, right? Like, it's a little uncharacteristic for a number one to come back and sit on the bench just because of the inherent risks, right? Like, the risk is you are one collision away from being thrust into a game in the middle of the second period after sitting around for an hour and a half. And coming off an injury that's kept you out this long, not having the same type of preparation you would have immediately before starting a game in terms of getting your body warm and doing all the work you have to do. And we know how hard Thatcher works and how meticulous he is on those details. So coming in cold off a bench after 6 months of not playing with an injury that has as many question marks as this one has had seems less than ideal. And that was the risk they ran. And that's why it seemed a little peculiar. And, I heard Jamie McLennan on earlier today on Donnie and Dolly sort of saying the same thing. And that's kind of the observation from around the NHL and the goalie world was that it felt a little odd. I'm sure there's reasons for it. Tockett said yesterday they have a plan. Presumably, though, that plan was to include Thatcher getting another full team practice in today, and they canceled it early this morning. So, you know, I don't know if that obviously isn't according to plan, and does that affect him starting tomorrow? We'll have to wait and find out. Now, that doesn't mean that he didn't skate, because that's the one thing if I learned over the years here. I don't know if it's changed since the goalie coach has changed, but quite often when the team was off, the goalies were not. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if Thatcher had skated today anyways. But still, that's not the team practice, right? That's not the full everybody flying around. Still can't imitate a game like you'd like to, but the closest thing you can get to it, you don't get that when team practice is canceled. So there are some things that make you kind of scratch your head a little bit about the timing and the way this has gone down, assuming he starts tomorrow. But as Rick said yesterday, they have a plan and they don't have to share that with us. And I'd be curious to see, you know, where Tuesday fits in versus say Friday or Sunday makes sense to me. I sort of get that. Again, you don't get your regular routine on a 1 PM start, although I know in the past on early starts, you know, they've done morning skates or goalie session morning skates in the wee hours to make sure it somewhat emulates that regular rhythm and getting the regular touches and the regular crease movement patterns that you like before you head into the net on a game day. So maybe 1 p.m. was too early for any of that and it just didn't make sense. But I think you could make the same argument that if a 1 p.m. start doesn't give you the proper warm-up, the potential for having to come in cold off the bench sure as hell wouldn't have either.
The other thing that comes up, and I think people are kind of more used to this with injuries to skaters that keep them out for a while, is like, hey, why doesn't he go play games in Abbotsford? Is that different for goalies? Like, is it a different, potentially more chaotic environment in Abbotsford that wouldn't be beneficial to his recovery? Or would it make sense for him to maybe play in Abbotsford for a game or two to get back up to speed?
I mean, you can probably make an argument for both, but it is not the same. Like, it's not the same game down there. It's a game of mistakes, more so down there than it is up here. And Thatcher's such a student of the game. He's such a gifted reader of the game. Like, his anticipation and the way he processes things in real time is sort of an unheralded, massive part of what makes him special. He really does think and process the game at an incredible level. And I think it's one of his separators that we don't talk about much. And, you know, that is based on processing, but also experience and what he's used to happening in front of him as a goaltender in the NHL would be different than what you might see in the American Hockey League. The shots are different. Some of the structure is different, and certainly some of the mistakes and some of the scramble plays that could put you in prone positions is different. So I could see the argument either way. Hey, is it game touches and reps without the pressure of the National Hockey League? Yes, but does it, you know, imitate the National Hockey League sufficiently? Certainly the traffic and stuff would be better or closer to game situations in the NHL than you're ever going to get out of practice. Like, guys will go in lanes, but they're not staying there. They're not eating pucks. They're not blocking shots. You're not getting all those broken plays you would in a game in practice, and you might in the American League. But I just think enough of it is different that I'm not surprised they decided not to go that route.
We know what Thatcher Demko is at full capacity, but
one of the best in the game, yeah.
One of the best in the game, period. But there's a lot, I think, of uncertainty here in how we should set our expectations and sort of how we should be evaluating this player given the long layoff, right? I mean, he's played three games since mid-March of 2024. The obvious uncertainty that we have about what recovery even looks like, what performance impact even looks like, what sort of workload he's going to be able to maintain coming back from the tear that he sustained. And then lastly, this is going to be the first time we've seen him, I mean, is it ever, without Ian Clark working with him as his goalie coach? Where should our expectations be? How long do you expect it to take Demko to ramp up into being the player that, you know, we've seen over the years?
I mean, the short answer is I don't know, and nobody does. And I've kind of said for the, pretty much since the season started that when he does come back, there needs to be a degree of patience attached to this. And yet I fully understand why people might have high expectations, because the reality is he's done it before. Come back off an injury and really, really good right out of the gate. This is different because a lot of the summer stuff you would normally have hasn't been there. You didn't start a season with the team. We've seen it with Jeremy Swayman, what even missing training camp can do. And there are some changes on this team, right? They're still a top 10 defensive team, but they're not a top 3 defensive team, which is what they were last year in terms of some of the stuff we're giving up. We've seen Kevin Lankinen and have to bail them out repeatedly, especially early in games with high danger chances to keep them in games. Big saves and big moments to allow them to hang around in some of these games. And so I think they need to be tempered. And yet my expectations are always high just because, I've said this for years. I truly believe he's one of those guys at the top of the league that I'm more than happy to put the tag elite on, right? Like, and that's not one that gets thrown around willy-nilly. I believe he's an elite top-tier goaltender in the National Hockey League. Hell, I would have found a way to include him on the American roster because, and I understand why they didn't, but I would have, because I think his upside is higher than the two guys behind Hellebuck. And we've seen that over the past couple of years when healthy. The Ian Clark thing is also a very fair question. Because Sergei Bobrovsky, I think his save percentage dropped 10 points. Jacob Markstrom, after leaving Ian Clark, dropped by a significant margin in that first year. And yet there are two things that make me worry less about it. One would be Marco Turanius, in addition to being a really good coach, has spent the last couple of years learning the system that Thatcher Demko learned under Ian Clark. And despite some whispers around the team about a desire to change how he plays, not because of the injury itself, but because of a belief that maybe that contributed to the injuries over the past number of years, Thatcher himself said that wasn't going to be the case, that there was no need to change and that he wasn't changing his style. So you've got a goalie coach that knows what that is and what drills they've used over the last number of years to sort of build confidence in that system of play that he uses. And the other part is the way I talked earlier about how he thinks the game, how well and how deeply he processes the game. Like, it really is impressive stuff. Now, at Ingle, we've been blessed in the past to have a sit down and go over video. And I've done this with now close to 40 goalies in the National Hockey League, including some of the best in the game, like Connor Hellebuck. And I can tell you, not everybody processes it and sees things and understands why they do things in relationship to what's happening in front of them at the level that Thatcher Demko does. And there are other guys, and I think Markey's a little bit one of them. It's not a criticism, but there are a lot of other guys that just go out and play. And so for a guy like Jacob Markstrom, I think a lot of the work that Ian did was so that he didn't have to think. So that all of it was innate without having to think about the drills they did. He just went and did them and did the work. And then when he went in the game, everything just happened. And so then you leave that and you start looking for, what drills were we doing? And I think Thatcher, there's just, again, everybody, it's not a criticism of the other guys, but I think Thatcher understands his game and the reasons for doing some of those things versus just going out and doing them at a different level. And because of that, I worry less about what it looks like without Ian Clark, at least from that perspective. Now, there are other things in terms of how hard he pushes and the work that goes into it and, arguments about how much that makes the movements innate when you're doing them all the time versus, I know there's been pushback the other way internally about doing it too much and creating extra wear and tear. So could there be some slippage there? Maybe. But I guess at the end of the day, having been around you know, all those guys, and Bob too in Columbus. I just think there's an understanding of how and why he plays that leads me to believe, at least think going into this, that it won't be as big a drop of off for that particular reason for Thatcher Demko coming back.
Hey, Woodley, really, really appreciate you taking the time and your insights. Thanks for this.
Thanks, guys.
There is Kevin Woodley on Sportsnet 650, brought to you by White Rock Hyundai. Visit the showroom on King George in White Rock or whiterockhyundai.com. We got to hit the break, but we'll hit some of your texts on the other side. You can text in 650-650, Dunbar Lumber text line if you have any questions or anything you want us to talk about. It is Josh Elliott Wolf and Thomas Strands here on Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk. Josh Elliott Wolf, Thomas Drantz. Listen to those horns. I love it. Man.
A horny version of House of the Rising Sun.
Man.
Never mind. It is Canucks Talk.
Dom has more wood than the Avalanche.
Not anymore.
Not anymore. The trip for Blackwood. Nothing can match Blackwood. Anyway, Canucks Talk is brought to you by the Hockey Shop in Langley.
Did we mention we just had Kevin Woodley on?
I actually thought about asking him to reflect on the woods that the Avalanche have added, but then I thought, nah.
Yeah.
Let's treat Woodley like he's a very serious guest, because he is.
You know what's unfortunate? I can't hit my fairway woods on the golf course.
Mm.
Well, nor can you hit any other club.
Better, though. I can hit them better.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to drag you. I'm sorry. Canucks Talk brought to you by the Hockey Shop in Langley. It's a great day for hockey. You can text in 650-650, Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and reno warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com, and we are coming to you live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? And finally, Sportsnet 650 and Barnside Brewing have dropped the gloves on a new pale ale that's perfect for hockey season. The brand new Five for Fighting Hazy Pale. This crisp and refreshing hazy pale ale is a celebration of flavor and balance. Brewed with our own farm-grown hops, it boasts a delightful harmony of fruity and floral notes. Each sip hints at the juicy essence of ripe peach, complemented by a soft, velvety mouthfeel that keeps it coming back for more.
Okay, doing reads over that soundtrack legit makes this seem like we're about to do a Price is Right game.
It's amazing. I love it.
And a new Barnside 4-pack comes
$1
in.
Four packs will be available starting today at Barnside Brewing Tap Room, participating retail locations, or on tap at your local pub. Go get them today.
By the way, I'm pretty sure that anyone that ever did the $1 more than their opponent guessed, those are the same people that recline on airlines.
That's whoa, dude. No,
we're not doing this.
That's
we're not
the
doing
strategy.
This. We're not doing this. We're not doing this.
This is the... Okay, the bad people.
Dom just said we're not doing this four times in a row. Just like, please, 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 please do not do this.
Anyway.
I have no time for people who think you cannot recline in an airline.
Okay, we don't have to talk about that, but Price is Right. You don't,
wow,
you don't like the
$1
over? I can't
believe, Dom, you're congenitally selfish. My goodness. Shocking. Shocking news.
Who would have thought?
This whole fad about you can't recline in an airplane only arose when the utter woke nonsense became a thing.
Whoa.
It's there. You can use it. Use it.
Anyway.
If everyone reclines, we've all got the same amount of space anyway.
Sorry, it's woke to have a baseline level of consideration
also,
for your fellow man
that's,
now?
That's not true, Dom. Because
yes,
the
is.
People in the back seat cannot recline.
Yes, they can.
They cannot.
Well, then
it's
don't,
right up against the wall.
Then don't book the back seat.
But
sucks
then,
to suck.
But then not everybody
sucks
has
to suck.
To, okay. Anyway. My headphones
recline
are
blown, away.
So I can't hear anything.
Recline
it's,
away.
It's woke nonsense to be baseline polite. Sure.
You're wrong about the Price is Right, though.
$1
over.
Wrong about both.
$1 over the highest guess. That's just strategy.
That's competitive advantage, Thomas.
No, it's rude.
Guessing $1, though, that's dumb.
You know who wins Price is Right, people? Or Price is Right prizes?
People.
People who don't care about being rude. It's a cutthroat business, Thomas.
Anyway, 650, 650, Dunbar Lumber Text.
It's a cutthroat business being a contestant on The Price is Right. Yeah. Okay, okay, bud.
Winning is winning.
It's a cutthroat business. That wheel is real intense. I love the wheel.
You're out there to take home the money.
It's not, well, you don't generally win money on The Price is Right.
That's not true.
It's prizes.
And money.
Most of the time it's prizes.
No, there's money involved.
I disagree. Anyway. I watch Price is Right every morning. No. No.
When you're sick at home?
Yes.
Bob Barker is my goat.
Yeah. Anyway, some texts on the 650-650 Dunbar Lumber text line. A few people texting in about your Pew Suter comments from earlier in the show. This one, unsigned. Suter averages 29 points per year. Not a $5 or $6 million player. I like him. He's doing well on the Canucks, but definitely not irreplaceable. So your take was that he's one of one.
Yeah, one of one. Just like you're not going to find a lot of guys around the league that are plus contributors as high up the lineup as top line winger and second or third line center.
Yeah, it's the utility that adds to it.
He's a massive floor raiser. Right? Like the ability to just put Pew Suter anywhere in the lineup and that line all of a sudden is better and goes. And it's any line in the top nine. Like we've seen him succeed as a top line wing in the playoffs. We've seen him succeed as a middle six center. Like, I don't know what we're talking about. A middle six center, a capable middle six center putting up 35 to 40 points a season, that's a $4 million player minimum. Usually it's five.
Yeah, like I don't know. Like the reason I say with Suter I don't go to five is just because I don't think he gets to five. But I can see your argument for him being worth five.
I think he does. I'm serious. Like I think it was such a massive whiff last time out by the league, and I suspect there's a couple of sharps that are going to correct that.
You think so? I feel like teams are going to look at it and they're going to convince themselves essentially the same thing they did last time, except this year they're going to look at it and be like, well, he had a high shooting percentage that, hey, like it'll probably come down throughout the course of the season. I could see four, though.
Those
maybe
are the
like
teams.
4.5.
Those are the teams that wouldn't bid $1 more than their competitors.
No, you're going to see it's going to be the woke teams, Dom. The teams that
the
actually,
woke teams.
Yeah, that actually are like, hey, I don't care that this guy's under 6 feet tall and under 180 pounds. He's just a good hockey player. He's a winning hockey player. I don't know what else to tell you. Like, think about, you know, Kiefer Sherwood's been a really nice fit. Danton Heinen's been a really nice fit. There is a gap between what those guys bring and what Pew Suter brings.
Yeah.
Like, there is a gap between what Hoglander and even Dakota Joshua, who has a super rare profile, actively contribute to the act of winning games.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like,
and we saw Joshua get paid, and obviously a lot of that is because of his size, and he's a rare type of player as well.
Yeah, he's like pint-sized Riley Smith who can play center. That's a $5 million player. I'm sorry. I don't know what else to tell you. It clearly is. And it's just a matter of, is everyone going to be wrong again? Like, it's not...
Why do we have to say pint-sized, man? That's what? So mean.
He's a pretty average-sized dude, too.
Pint-sized?
But compared to Riley Smith.
Yeah, Riley Smith's a big dude.
Okay.
Anyway.
I don't know. Pettersson describes Hoglander as a pint-sized power forward.
Does he actually?
Yeah.
Our short king's out here just getting dragged.
That's how it goes. That's how it goes.
Yeah, Riley Smith's 2 inches taller. It's not that much pint.
He's pint-sized. Hey, you know what? 2 inches matters.
You know what? Also, in hockey, the difference between being listed at 6'1", where it's like you're actually 6 feet for sure, and being listed at 5'11", where it's like you could be anything from 5'8" to... you know, or up, it's like, it's 2 inches as it's listed, but it's probably more like four.
And you don't like, for
and
me,
2 inches matters.
2 inches matters. For me personally, I didn't notice this.
To the Avalanche.
To the We were towing a line. We were trying not to.
Josh is our pint-sized Jamie Dodd.
I feel like I'm taller than Jamie Dodd.
Facts don't matter.
Oh, fair enough. Anyway, 650, 650. Dunbar Lumber text line. There was someone, and I lost them. Oh, here it is. Tommy, who's texted in five times about Brock Besser, wanting us to talk about Brock Besser. So I will appease Tommy right now. Tommy is asking, pay or trade Brock Besser?
Well, it's a decision the club's going to have to make relatively quickly here, which, yes. Adds some stakes to this. We've seen that this team doesn't tend to hold players they don't intend to sign past the deadline. Now, they did it last year with Zadorov and Lindholm because they were, leading their division. I suspect they'll take a similar approach with Besser given the ambitions that this team is carrying itself with. But, we are getting to a fork in the road. I think part of the reason why there were no substantive talks in the offseason was Besser had just gone off for 40 goals. He'd never previously hit 30. He'd performed at a level that was an outlier relative to his career norm. And, I think there's a sense of, hey, well, look, before we pay you off that level, you got to do it again. And that's why Patrick Alvin very explicitly was challenging him to push for 50, suggested that maybe he took his foot off the gas a little bit down the stretch last season. I think there's a appetite to see Brock Besser prove that wasn't a fluke, that was who he is. And all of that said, I think there is some belief that is indeed who he is. And for what it's worth, 7 goals in 19 games this season, right? That's a healthy clip. That's a 30 goal pace that Besser has been on despite, dealing with a multi-week absence for a concussion stemming from a really dirty hit by Tanner Jeannot. And, Besser's really good. Besser's a really good player, really smart. He's their best winger. He's this team's best winger.
Yeah.
I ultimately do think he gets done in Vancouver. That's my overarching hunch of how this plays out. I think Besser likes it here. I think the team is high on him. I think he'll remain. But, the club has to be pretty cognizant of how they manage this. I mean, can you go higher than you have on Miller with Besser?
I think you have to.
I think you have to too, but I don't think that's a decision that the club can make lightly, right? And then do you trade Max Term? Like, would you go 8 times 8? Would he? Are we talking 9 times 8? Right? Yeah. Like, Besser's going to be one of the top wingers. It's like Mitch Marner and Brock Besser.
Yeah.
Mitch Marner, then Brock Besser.
And Rantanen.
And Rantanen. Yeah. So one of the three most prized wingers in an unrestricted free agent market that could be in the $15 million range. I mean, realistically, mid-90s upper limit, you're going to see serious money getting thrown around by teams competing to land these 30-goal capable wingers. And so, it's a very delicate balance to have to sort of bridge. I expect the team to find a way to keep him. I think the player will be motivated enough to stay. It's certainly a situation to monitor that the Minnesota Wild are about to get out of cap hell, right? It's his hometown team. Lots of rumors over the years about shared interest. And of course, we've seen a lot of Minnesota-grown players, well, specifically Ryan Suter and... Ryan Suter's not actually from Minnesota, but Midwest, and then Zach Parise go home, right? So certainly a situation to be mindful of in our discussion of this. That's not me reporting anything. That's just obvious connecting of dots. So, we'll see. There's time. But I do think, he should be a priority too. I think with Lankanen, you're probably going to wait, right? So there's 4 key UFAs. There's Besser, there's Suter, there's Lankanen, and there's Brännström, right? And of the 4...
And Brännström's an RFA, by the way.
Really?
Yeah.
Because of his age. Wow. I hadn't realized that. That's a steal. That's fantastic for Vancouver. Although he'll be an arbitration-eligible RFA.
Mm-hmm.
And, with a fairly hefty production and minutes profile, probably not a guy that you'll necessarily take to arbitration, right? Because he's exactly the guy you non-tender. Because if he finishes with like 15 or 20 points and he's playing 16 minutes a night for your team... then you're looking at like a $3.5 million award, which is like enough to be inconvenient for a guy you don't believe in as a top 4.
Yeah.
But not so much that you can walk away from. Right. So Brännström's actually, we'll get into Brännström later. So those are the key free agents that the Canucks have expiring. Besser and Suter, I think, are guys you have to move a little proactively with. And I think if you're going to try and keep them, you should try and get it done over the next 3 months. This organization has done a lot of deals over the years, you know, in that like January window. They often like to take Christmas. They have pro scouting meetings usually early in January, and they often emerge from those meetings with a plan. And that's when we see like momentum start on Kuzmenko, right? Yeah. That's when we saw momentum start on Pettersson, right? So, you know, that's sort of been their MO, is at the same time that you make final preparations for the deadline, you also make final preparations to begin negotiating with your priority players. For me, both Besser and Pugh Suter would be priorities, guys that I'd look to see the club get done proactively. You know, this team's positioned, I mean, they have $5.5 million in dead space next season because the Oliver Ekman-Larsson buyout jumps, and because they'll have the final year of the Ilya Mikheyev retained salary trade on their books. That's like, I think league average is something like $1.5 million in dead space. So that's inefficient. That sucks for the Canucks. And yet, you know, when you look at the money they have committed for next season, you know, I do tend to think that they're going to have the space, the requisite space to maintain any of the guys that they want and still probably have enough to take a swing on the back end. Now, obviously, that depends exactly on how much money goes where, right? If Besser's 9 versus 7.5, that makes a material difference. If Pugh Suter comes in at 4.5 as opposed to 3, that makes a material difference. But those are two guys that I would try to keep if I was the Canucks and try to get done proactively. Lankinen is interesting because this team and frankly, Jim Rutherford, period, has never spent on the backup position.
Yeah.
Now, I think that needs to change. My view is, and this is, people remember, I was banging the table in the spring last year saying the Canucks should address their backup goaltending position proactively, prioritize it in the summer, because I wasn't sure what Demko's situation, how that would play out. And Artur Shelov's didn't have a deep enough track record that I thought the club should feel as comfortable as they seemed to with the idea of him being a backup. And this was before we realized that Demko's injury would keep him out until mid-December, which is where we're at now, right?
Yeah.
Ultimately, Lankinen got done, and I think that saved their year. But you know, fundamentally, with the injuries that Demko has had and with the need to keep him fresh, in my view, like the next 2 years with Demko, I don't think this team should be looking at riding him as a workhorse starter. I don't think he should be playing 65 games because if they want to win the Stanley Cup, you want the fresh goalie advantage, especially with a guy who, frankly, has never been, you know, a workhorse to the point of making it through an entire 65 game season, posting an above average or better save percentage, and being healthy and at your best toward the end of the year. Like, that's just not something he's done. If I'm the Canucks, it's not that I don't believe he can do it either. It's that I think you're best off not taking the risk with a team that you think might have a shot at winning it all.
That's kind of the point, is like, hey, you can take that risk. It's just going to be incredibly bold. And if it doesn't work out and your next best option is Artur Shelov's, we've seen it work in the past, but to a certain level. And I don't think that certain level is Stanley Cup contender.
No, it's just not worth the risk. So, yeah. But what I would say is, before this club extends Lankinen, like, how many games has he started? 20-ish, roughly? We're at the sort of 20 Lankinen games.
Yep.
Mark, I want to see what Demko looks like, what sort of workload he's able to hold down, if he's able to avoid it, re-injury or compensation injuries on his return to the lineup. Like, there's so much uncertainty that I wouldn't want to make a decision one way or the other in net unless, you know, Lankinen and his camp were cutting us a serious discount, which they're not going to do. So that to me is one where just info gather for maximum amount of time before deciding one way or the other what to do in goal. I would be kicking the can down the road on Lankinen, especially given how difficult it is to maintain a level of performance as solid as he has over the course of this season to this point. Plus, I want to see what Shelovs can do and if he bounces back and how much trust I'm going to put in him to be the backup at a much lower cap number next season before making a decision one way or the other. I think that's best practice for how the Canucks approach things with Lankinen. And then Brännström's an interesting one, as we noted, right? He is a very difficult guy to qualify.
Yeah.
He's going to be right in that crunchy middle where his case is a little too strong for you to comfortably take to arbitration. But, you know, he's probably too good to leave hitting the market as a UFA at his age. So the way that they approach that one is additionally complicated. We've seen the Canucks go through this with a variety of players. We've seen them both non-tender guys, and we've seen them use the qualifying offer deadline to stimulate a resolution, as they did in Brock Besser's case a few years back. I'm sure people will remember. So, you know, this one will be a trickier one, a more complicated one, and yet because he remains an RFA, his value is relatively well defined, which sort of narrows the band. He might be a guy who, if you believe in as like a nice third pair fit and a guy who can, you know, help you bring along your Cole McWard, your Tom Volander, your Elias Pettersson tier guys going forward, just as like a good guy in the room, good depth. He might be a guy you try and do term with to in exchange for a lower cap number. He's bounced around a fair bit. He's been through the rigors of being non-tendered and, you know, going to a training camp and getting traded before the season and on and on. Like, sometimes those guys are willing to do, like, you know, 1.5 times three,
yeah,
right? And just sort of lock it in. I feel like if you're going to try and get it done early, and I feel like this is one that the Canucks are more likely to get done at the wire, you know, not proactively, just given their history of conducting business. I feel like that's sort of one where you wait to the wire, and then if you want to use term to bring down the cap number, you can, or you try and get a classic like 1 year, 1.5 done. And if not, then you non-tender and you go replace him. For me, the Brännström player type is easier to replace than the Pius Suter or the Brock Besser and potentially the Kevin Lankinen.
Yeah.
Although they did an excellent job finding Lankinen on the scrap heap in September.
Definitely. With Brännström, too, I just don't know if he's their ideal third-pairing guy. Based on everyone they brought in throughout this management's history, it doesn't really seem like he's the kind of guy they like on the third pair. And it, like, to an extent, he was a throw-in in that trade. And then he went down to Abbotsford, cleared waivers, too. And it's worked out for the Canucks since. But I just don't know how enamored they would be with that type of player on their third pair. At the very least, enough to give like 3 years to, even if it was at 1.5. But maybe they like him. I don't know. Hard to say. We'll see how it develops over the season.
I think there's definitely people in the organization that really like what Brännström has brought, but I think there's also some clear trepidation. They definitely want more size on the back end than he can provide. So, you know, and that's not something that's going to change. That's not something you can learn, unfortunately. So, you know, it will be fascinating to see how they track it. I think the main takeaway from Brännström is just the fact that he has arbitration rights puts him right in the middle that teams are sometimes uncomfortable navigating. And it'll be fascinating to see, too, if teams are less sort of trepidatious in how they approach extension talks or qualifying offers for guys in Brännström's shoes in sort of a higher cap environment going forward.
That's going to do it for the show today. Appreciate everyone texting in 650-650 Dunbar Lumber text line. Everyone listening as well. Thank you to Zach. Thank you to Dom. Thank you to Lena producing the show. Thank you to Thomas Drantz. I have been Josh Elliott Wolf. This has been Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650.